Americans used to counting their change and other tangible transactions in the U.S. economy might be a little put off by a lifelong commodities trader who every day helps set the price of pork bellies or soybeans, but has never seen a living pig or even a real pork belly. Making markets involves attracting money to some location where large amounts of goods can be bought and sold. The prices set in those markets make the world go round. Chicago sets the price of corn, rice, and crude oil. London sets the price of money itself on its currency exchange. It all seems so solid until you realize it's just a series of bets on whether prices will go up or down. Oh, sure, there are oil producers and farmers who just want to know the price and get on with their lives, but it is those bettors, the speculators, who really drive the market. The global economic system, in fact, is the story of the break-all-the-rules speculator trying to stay ahead of the settle-down-everyone regulators. Market crashes of 1929 and 2008 show that sometimes the gamblers get the best of the system and everyone loses. Stuart Banner's latest book, Speculation, A History of the Fine Line Between Gambling and Investing, takes you right into the belly of the beast. The Chicago Board and Trade was formed in the mid-19th century. It immediately became the most essential institution for the growth of agriculture and the most hated institution in America.
Organizations like the Board of Trade facilitated the creation of an international agricultural market that allowed stability in prices, predictability, and so on. Farmers were less subject to fluctuations in prices. So it had some useful things. On the other hand, it seemed mighty suspicious to a lot of people that all these deals were going on, that all these commodities were nominally being bought and sold, but there weren't any actual commodities there. So whenever times were hard for farmers, when prices were low, farmers often grew quite suspicious of the boards of trade for what they thought was causing the price to the farmer to be lower than it would have been otherwise.
Is this the tension that is at the center of speculation, this tension between the ability to trade in the abstract and actually set a real price for something, and this, I don't know, more ancient kind of visceral need to see something in front of you, a bushel of corn, a brick of silver, that you can't quite buy into the possibility that this abstract trading business is real?
Yeah, and from the perspective of a farmer, you know, so if say you're a farmer and someone tells you, and this would be truthful, that the price of what you're growing is determined by transactions on the board of trade, and you might say, well, who are these people, right? Why do they get to determine the price of what I sell? Because, you know, they've never seen any corn or any wheat themselves. You know, why is it that they have such power over my life? Now, you know, that's the critique of speculation, you know, but on the other side, the existence of these organizations was a great benefit to farmers most of the time.
And it's also the case that deep down, Americans love the idea that you can gamble a little bit.
Yeah, love it and hate it at the same time, you know. I mean, there's always been this kind of tension in moral terms about speculation, because people have always instinctively drawn a distinction between producers who are actually adding to the size of the pie and speculators who in a common view are just chopping up the pie into different slices. Now, that's not really right. That is, speculators are adding to the pie in a sense, but it's in an indirect sense. It's a sense that's it's a lot harder to see.
I'm looking at this latest bank fiasco of Wells Fargo. It seems as though we talk a good game about the Goldman Sachs's of the world and the investment banks of the world that risk depositors' money on, you know, risky sort of speculative transactions. And this is what Congress has attempted to regulate for decades. But when a bank does what Wells Fargo did, just rip people off with fees, that is a capital punishment. We won't necessarily punish a bank for making a risk because, hey, it could have been great. You know, we could have benefited. Everybody sort of gets into the casino idea, but boy, you charge somebody an inappropriate fee and that's the end.
Let's draw a distinction between speculation and fraud, right? No one defends fraud. I mean, fraud does that's bad. Fraud in the context of speculation or in any context. But the harder question is whether speculation itself, just put fraud aside. No one's fooling anyone. Just people taking risks, either with their money or with money entrusted to them by others. It's whether that's good or bad that I think is the more interesting question, and it's been the more divisive question. And so, for centuries we've tried to distinguish between the good and the bad, to say, okay, certain transactions, say, are too risky, we're not going to allow those. The problem has always been that the same things that make speculation dangerous also make it useful. And so the more you restrict speculation to remove the dangers, the less benefit you're getting from speculation. And so, and our policy towards speculation over the years has always oscillated between restriction and relaxation of controls. And it's not that surprising that after a financial crisis, after a stock market crash, for example, people tend to get more interested in regulating the market and cutting back on speculation, whereas when the market is rising, when things are good, those restrictions tend to get relaxed, at least in practice. No elected official wants to spoil the party when things are going well, but when things are going poorly, speculators are a tempting target.
So in your investigation of speculation, did you at the end of the day feel more or less secure about the financial system after all of your exploration of history?
It's hard to say. I mean, because of the technology involved, the financial system today is very different from the way the financial system was really at any time in the past. A single event can reverberate a lot more quickly than was possible in the past. On the other hand, a lot of the arguments you hear for and against speculation or for and against regulation of speculators, a lot of those arguments have scarcely changed, in 200 years. That's honestly what got me started with this project, is that in the most recent financial crisis a few years ago, there were a lot of arguments for and against trading in derivatives, for and against various proposed kinds of regulation. And I had done some work on the financial crises of the 18th century, the South Sea Bubble in England and the crash of 1792 in the United States. And the thing that I found really striking was that a lot of the arguments for and against speculation a few years ago were really similar to the arguments that you heard or that I read from the 18th century. And despite the fact that the technology underpinning markets has changed so much, and despite the fact that our understanding of markets is so much better. I mean, economic knowledge has actually changed a lot. It's improved a lot. And so in some ways, the arguments today are different. They're made with a technical vocabulary that didn't exist a couple hundred years ago. But in a lot of ways, they really are the same arguments we've been having for a long time, because, at bottom, they are moral arguments. They're arguments about the moral propriety of particular kinds of behavior.
Stuart Banner, professor of law at UCLA. His latest book is Speculation, A History of the Fine Line Between Gambling and Investing.